This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Night Trade by Barry Eisler, performed by the author. For the memory of Major Douglas C. Pat, U.S. Army, retired. Son of Arthur and Helen, father of Kara, Michael, and Gavin, loving partner of Vivian, who enjoyed these books and made them so much better. Chapter 1. Livia was warming up on the mats at Seattle Police Headquarters when her lieutenant, Donna Strangeland, came through the swinging doors at the far end of the gym. Alongside Strangeland was a big man in a gray suit, the jacket cut loosely, enough to conceal, say, a holster and a good-sized pistol. A visitor's badge was clipped to one of the man's lapels, but he strode in as confidently as though he owned the building. Fed, Livia thought. For one bad second, she flashed on what she had done to the senator and his men in that Bangkok hotel room. But no, she was just being paranoid. If this had been about the senator, she'd be getting a visit from a platoon of FBI agents and the chief, not a single Fed and the lieutenant. Besides, there was another possibility. A few weeks earlier, Strangeland had mentioned something about a Homeland Security Joint Anti-Trafficking Task Force. Maybe that was what this was about. Strangeland and the visitor walked past the group of men lifting weights in one corner and the two-on-two basketball game in the other, then stopped in the center of the cavernous space. Livia could see them conferring, but over the clank of the weightlifters' barbells and the squeak of the basketball players' sneakers and the reverberating dribble of their ball, she couldn't hear any of the conversation. Then Strangeland caught Livia's eye and motioned for her to come over. Whatever this guy was here for, it seemed they weren't supposed to discuss it in front of the class Livia was teaching. Livia nodded in acknowledgement and glanced at the six women cops limbering up around her. "Start from the guard," she said. "You know the drill. Protect the weapon and control the distance. Escape and create more distance. Draw and 360. I'll be back in a minute." She walked over to Strangeland and the man. He was black and completely bald, with a big pair of eyeglasses in green plastic frames. Mid-40s, maybe 6'2 and 220. She wondered if he'd played football in his younger days. He had the build for it, though it looked as though what had once been just muscle was now covered with a layer of fat. Maybe more time at a desk than in the field. He smiled as Livia approached, an exceptionally sunny smile she sensed he used to lull people. "Sorry to interrupt," Strangeland said in her trademark Brooklyn transplant accent, raising her voice over the sounds of the bouncing basketball and the music the weightlifters were playing. "Livia, this is Special Agent Little. Homeland Security Investigations." Livia looked at him but said nothing. If he was expecting her to go first, he'd be waiting a long time. She'd known even before becoming a cop that people gave away a lot more talking than they did listening. Little's smile broadened, maybe in recognition of Livia's composure. "Livia Lone," he said, conceding. He held out his hand. "I've been looking forward to meeting you." They shook. He had big hands and a good grip, but he neither overdid nor underdid it the way some men would to demonstrate superior strength or their views on equality or whatever. She noticed that by saying her full name, he avoided having to choose between Officer Lone, which might have seemed too deferential, and Livia, which might have seemed too familiar. And maybe he was trying to build rapport, too, because a good interrogator knows there are no more beautiful words in the world than someone's own name. She'd read somewhere that if you walked up and said a person's full name three times, the person couldn't help but smile. "What do I call you?" she asked, wanting to see how he would play that end of the introduction. "Well, the full name is Benjamin Dixon Little, but most people call me B.D.
"B.D., then?"
She considered making a joke about a man of his size being named Little, but decided he'd probably been hearing cracks like that since he was a teenager. Strangeland glanced at Little, then back to Livia. Special Agent Little is here to talk to you about that joint task force I mentioned. I would have given you a heads up, but I didn't get one myself. Livia caught the deliberate rebuke, and so, apparently, did Little, because he said, "Apologies for that. Things are coming along a little faster than I'd expected." It wasn't much of an explanation for a no-knock visit. Livia was familiar with the practice of dropping by for an interview without giving the person of interest a chance to prepare, and she didn't much appreciate being on the other end of it. "I hope you won't mind," she said, "but for the next hour I have a class to teach. You're welcome to stick around and watch if you want." Or, she glanced at Lieutenant Strangeland, suddenly inspired, "In fact, why don't you roll around with us? We usually have one of the big SWAT guys act as Uke, but today it's just us girls. We could use your help." Lieutenant Strangeland smiled ever so slightly. She knew Livia was messing with Little, and obviously didn't object. Maybe she'd even brought him down here with this outcome in mind. Little glanced over at Livia's students, who were now drilling from the guard as she had instructed them, defenders on their backs, legs wrapped around their partners, protecting bright green plastic training pistols while attacking the eyes, clearing the legs, scrambling free. The gym echoed with shouts of, "Do not move!" as successive trainees escaped, cleared leather, gained distance, and pointed their weapons at their attackers, all the while doing a tactical visual sweep for danger at the periphery. "This is, what, a woman's self-defense class?" Little asked, trying to buy time. "Defensive tactics against a bigger, heavier attacker," Livia said. "What works on the street for someone like you isn't generally suitable for a small woman." For an instant, Livia thought she saw something pass across Little's face. Wistfulness? Sadness? Disdain? "You don't approve," Livia said. Whatever had opened up in Little's expression was suddenly gone. "I approve very much," he said. "Livia's got a grappling background," Strangeland said. Little chuckled. "Is that what you call Idaho State Wrestling Champion in high school and Judo Olympic alternate in college?" So Little had done his homework and wanted them to know it, too. "Have you had any training?" Livia said. Little shook his head. "Not much." She knew he was lying. "Not much" meant either none or a lot. Probably the latter. "Well?" Livia said. Little glanced over at the basketball game.
"I think that game over there would be safer."
Livia smiled. "But not nearly as much fun."
"Ha! Well, I'd plead the absence of a gi, but I expect you'd just offer to lend me one. And besides, I see you're all wearing street clothes."
Livia shrugged. "We try to keep it realistic." There was a pause. Then Little laughed and loosened his tie.
"All right," he said. "I guess I can't refuse. The honor of Homeland Security seems to be at stake."
"I'd like to stay," Strangeland said, "but I've got things to do." She nodded at Livia. The nod said, "I want to know what this is all about." Livia returned the nod, and Strangeland turned and left. Livia and Little walked over to the mats.
"Good news," Livia said.
The women disengaged and paused, watching them. "This is Special Agent B.D. Little from Homeland Security Investigations, and he's volunteered to be our Uke today." Little gave the assembled women the sunny smile.
"Well, volunteered might be a strong word, but yes, I'm happy to help if I can."
"Weapons against that wall," Livia said, pointing. Little walked to the wall and did as she said, pulling off his jacket, setting it down, and then removing his belt, holstered gun, and spare mags. He set the gun belt down on top of the jacket, then took off his tie and glasses and added them as well. "Knife?" Livia called out to him, because it wasn't uncommon for cops to conceive of their firearms as weapons and their knives as tools. He shook his head. "Not a street operator," she thought, confirming her initial impression. "Desk jockey." Little added his wallet, keys, and watch to the pile by the wall, then walked back onto the mat.
"Okay," Little said, stopping a few feet from Livia. "I'm disarmed. How can I be of service?"
His overall friendliness seemed in line with his smile, something Livia sensed he would use to get people to underestimate him. She cautioned herself not to make that mistake.
One problem we've seen again and again, Livia said, is the blitz by a big attacker against a smaller cop, the kind that happens so suddenly the cop doesn't have time to get offline or access a weapon, and winds up falling to the ground or getting slammed into a wall, at which point the attacker presses his advantage. What we're doing is creating a kind of tactical pause within which, without a word, Little lunged at her like a defensive lineman intent on sacking the quarterback. Somewhere far back in her mind, a voice was shouting, "This is exactly what he was setting you up for, what you should have expected." But the voice barely registered. Her body took over, dropping low as he plowed into her, her left leg coming up around his waist, her right heel planted in his crotch, her arms disrupting his grab and taking hold of his lapels as the two of them crashed to the mat. The impact was hard but was distributed all over her body, whereas Little absorbed it mostly through the foot jammed into his testicles. He grunted in pain but kept his weight on her, and she shifted her foot, kicked his leg back, and shot her leg up and around his neck in a triangle choke. She was right about the training, though, because he reacted immediately, planting a foot alongside her butt, dragging her closer, and bracing to come to his feet. Standing and then slamming was a common tactic for a larger, stronger opponent to employ when caught in the guard, and before he could manage it, she released the choke, pivoted on her back, hooked one of his heels in a cupped palm, and kicked him onto his ass, using his backward momentum to pull herself forward and into a squat. The tactical move at that point would have been to scoot back, create distance, and draw the practice pistol. But Little had been trying to make a point, and she was damn sure going to make one in return. So rather than scuttle away, she hopped forward and planted the sole of her right foot against the side of his face, rotating his head away and shoving it into the mat. He tried to roll with the pressure, exactly what she was looking for. She snared his left elbow, grabbed his wrist with her free hand, and dropped back to the mat, popping her hips up and straightening his arm to the limit. Little howled and tried to turn into her, but between the foot planted against his face and the opposite leg across his chest, he was out of options. She cranked the arm bar harder.
"Okay, okay, uncle,"
Little cried out, his voice distorted by the foot against his face. Livia kept the arm extended, a millimeter from hyperextension.
"You sure?" she said. "You don't want to keep going?"
"No, no, no. You've made your point."
"You going to be a good dance partner? Or are you going to try to trip me up again?"
"Hey, how stupid do you think I am? You win. I'll be good."
Livia released the arm and rolled away from him. She glanced around, the 360 perimeter check, a conditioned reflex. The women were all smiling. One of them, a senior sex crimes detective named Suzanne Moore, called out, "That's what I'm talking about!" and started clapping. The other women followed suit. Little sat up slowly, doubled forward from the pain of the ball shot and breathing heavily. He rubbed his elbow and nodded at the applause as though to say, "Yeah, okay, I deserved that." Livia held up a hand to the class, appreciative but also embarrassed.
"Okay," she said. "Let's focus. What did I do wrong?"
"Not break his arm?"
Moore offered. The rest of the women laughed. Livia smiled. Moore was a good cop and one of the women who had taken Livia under their wings when Livia was a rookie.
"Seriously," Livia said, "what are our tactical goals?"
"Protect the weapon and control the distance. Escape and create more distance. Draw and 360, the women said in unison.
"Correct. And when was my best opportunity to do that?"
"When you tripped him," Moore said.
"Correct again. A perfect opportunity. Now, I didn't take it because Special Agent Little here had a point he was trying to make, and I wanted to respond in a way I knew he'd understand."
There were some light chuckles, including from Little himself, and Livia continued.
"But let's not confuse what sometimes happens on the mat with proper tactics on the street. Agent Little just did us all a favor by showing how fast you can get body slammed from the guard, especially by a bigger, stronger attacker. You know I love grappling. But the ground is not where you want to be, it's where you want to get up from. So today, let's drill the guard to the body slam lift, to the heel hook, to the escape. Agent Little, you up for that?"
Little half smiled, half winced. "As long as it's the escape and not the armbar,
I'd be honored to be of continued assistance.
For the next hour, he was the perfect training partner, with a nice sense of how hard to push depending on the skill levels of his partners. And from the way he moved, Livia saw again that she'd been right in thinking he had some training, more, it seemed, than the standard hand-to-hand offered in military basic or to law enforcement cadets. At one point, Moore tried to armbar him, despite Livia's admonition that the point was escape, not further entanglement. But her technique was less refined than Livia's, and Little's counter had been sound, saving his arm from further injury. When the hour was done, Little's stunt had been largely forgotten, replaced by a certain level of mutual respect and appreciation. The women collected their weapons, picked up bottles of water, and filed past him, shaking his hand and exchanging a few bluff courtesies. Moore was last. As she shook Little's hand, she nodded and said, "You're lucky my girl was in a good mood today." Little smiled.
"Yeah, that much I figured out on my own."
Moore returned the smile. "Okay, now you know." She paused, then added, "Thanks for being a good training partner." Little flexed his arm, which Livia knew would be sore for days.
"My pleasure, or at least it will be once I get some ice on this elbow."
Moore laughed and moved off, the squeak of her shoes on the polished wood floor echoing off the high ceiling. The basketball game was done and disbanded, the weightlifters departed, and once Moore had gone through the swinging doors, the only sound was the hum of an overhead air conditioning unit. Little flexed his arm again. His shirt was soaked.
"She tried to finish what you'd started. I was lucky to get out of it."
Livia shrugged and handed him a bottled water.
"One of my mentors. She's protective."
He nodded his thanks at the water, unscrewed the cap, and drained it, exhaling deeply when he was finished.
"I don't think you need it."
"Anyway, it wasn't just luck. You've had some training."
"Not as much as I'd like. Mostly high school wrestling. I should come by more often. Take your class."
"All the way from D.C.?"
"Why do you think I'm based in D.C.?"
"Just a guess. Homeland Security, right?"
"Other than the FBI, HSI is the largest criminal investigative agency in the U.S. government, with over 400 domestic field offices and 60 overseas attaché offices. You know the work we do against human trafficking."
She certainly did, and Special Agent Little, it seemed, was too smart for her to play dumb with.
"Okay," she said, "then where are you based?"
He smiled.
"Oh, I move around a lot."
She didn't respond. Apparently, he liked games, and there was no way to win this one. The best move was just not to play.
"I'm sorry about rushing you on the mat earlier," he said.
"Of course you are."
He laughed.
"I mean, apart from you making me sorry. I've just heard so much about you, and I wanted to see for myself."
"I don't know what you heard or what you saw."
"What I've heard is you can handle yourself and then some, and I saw that was true. I also hear you prefer to operate alone. Most of all, that you close cases."
"Who have you been talking to?"
"Lieutenant Strangeland, for one. She says you're the best sex crimes detective she's ever seen. Of course, I wasn't supposed to quote her on that."
She knew from her own fitness reports how highly the lieutenant thought of her. So maybe Strangeland had praised her a little, or maybe he was bullshitting to distract from other sources.
"What's your interest, Special Agent Little?"
"Please call me BD. And my interest is why I'm here. Is there some place we could sit for a while?" He flexed the injured arm and smiled. "Hopefully with a nearby ice machine."
Chapter 2. Docs knew he needed to get the hell out of Phnom Penh, probably out of Cambodia entirely. He told himself in the heat of the moment that Gant was nothing but a pissant, but he had to acknowledge now that he might have been rationalizing because he'd wanted to kill the man so damn much. With the benefit of hindsight, though, he was starting to realize that when word went out about Gant's head getting turned into a fine pink mist, and likely by the very guy Gant had hired to do the same to someone else, there might possibly be a bit of blowback. So he walked south, skirting wide of the U.S. Embassy because said blowback would likely be coming from exactly there, and bought a cell phone for cash from a street vendor, then continued southwest toward the Olympic Market, armadas of tuk-tuks and motor scooters buzzing all around him. It was 11 in the morning in Cambodia, so midnight in Langley, but he knew Kanazaki kept late hours. Hell, that boy worked harder than anyone Docs had ever known at the agency. They ought to give him a damn medal. Though if they knew he was not above the occasional dispatch of a former Marine sniper with considerable charm but a bit of a shady past, they'd as likely reward him with a prison cell. He wandered, sweating in the tropical humidity even in his cargo shorts and loose T-shirt, periodically checking the phone's Wi-Fi settings for an unprotected internet connection. When he found one, on the sidewalk in front of a dilapidated coffee shop, he paused to download the Signal app from Open Whisper Systems, then configured it for the call he wanted to make, looking up from time to time to check his surroundings. The Olympic Market was popular with tourists, and there were clots of foreigners among the crowds of locals, which made it a bit easier to blend. At near 6 feet and a solid 225, though, he would always draw a certain amount of attention, especially in Asia, where his sandy-colored hair and goatee were also conspicuous. Sometimes he liked to hide in plain sight by being ostentatiously loud and Texas-friendly, but he also had the sniper's knack for retracting his energy, his presence, when he needed to, so that despite his size and whatever his surroundings, people tended not to take much notice of him. When he was done with the configurations, he moved to the shade under a nearby palm tree and put the call through. The phone rang only once. Either Kanazaki kept it by the bed or, more likely, he wasn't even sleeping. Then the familiar voice, crisp and professional. Kanazaki here. A second-generation Japanese-American, Kanazaki's first name was Tomohisa, but he went by Tom.
Buenas noches, amigo, Doc said. It's fine to hear your voice.
There was a pause.
It's fine to hear yours, too.
Read me the ID?
At the outset of the encrypted call, Signal provided each user with a unique number. If the numbers didn't match, it meant someone was listening in. Kanazaki read the number aloud.
All right, Docs told him. We're good to go. Nice to know there are still a few means of privacy left in this brave new world of ours.
Why do I get the sense you're not calling with good news?
Well, now you've gone and hurt my feelings. I thought just hearing from me was good news.
Aside from that, he said, and Docs could imagine him smiling. What can I do for you?
Okay, I'll get right to the point, especially because you already have. I'm calling from Phnom Penh.
Oh, God. That didn't sound promising.
What, you don't like Cambodia? The food is great and the women are beautiful.
I should have known you'd be mixed up in this.
Oh, hell, what have you heard?
We got a cable this morning from the embassy in Phnom Penh. Some guy got his head blown off at a restaurant alongside the Mekong River, and the UN official he was having dinner with says the guy claimed to be U.S. intelligence. But according to this official, the guy never specified what agency, and there was no ID on his body. So the embassy cabled every member organization in the entire U.S. intelligence community, asking if anyone could take ownership of the dead guy. So far, no one has. I think it's nice that y'all have your own community.
You going to make jokes, or do you want to exchange some information here?
I don't see why it has to be one or the other.
Okay, you've done the one. Now where's the other? For Kanazaki, intel was always the coin of the realm, and his greed for it was usually something exploitable, but only for something in return.
All right, I happen to know that the deceased called himself Gant. First name, unknown.
And you know this how?
Well, that's how he introduced himself when he hired me. He said to kill a guy named Sorm, Rithisak Sorm, who, he gave me to understand, is a notorious Cambodian child trafficker. But then I showed up and saw who this Sorm really was, a guy I'd seen that very morning at the Raffles Hotel, surrounded by a bunch of foreign dignitaries who looked like the damn Dalai Lama, and I could tell was a decent man.
You can tell that just by looking? A motorbike with high-output pipes went by, drowning out the background din of people and traffic. Docs waited until it had passed.
Sometimes I can. Always had a good feeling about you, son, and I still do despite your suspect professional affiliations. Are you going to tell me I'm wrong?
Never.
Anyway, once I saw the target, I knew for sure there was something rotten in Denmark. Then old Gant came clean, told me actually the target wasn't Sorm. The target was a UN guy who was trying to prosecute Sorm for his crimes. And that Gant had to protect Sorm despite his shady dealings because he was some kind of U.S. intelligence asset. I said, fuck all that, and sayonara, went back to my motorcycle ready for a clean getaway, and lo and behold, three Cambodian ne'er-do-wells are waiting for me in the darkness with knives. But luckily for me, and unluckily for them, being a careful man, I took an unexpected route to the motorbike, so the element of surprise was mine. Plus, there was a matter of I had night vision, and they didn't. So our encounter ended happily for our hero, and less happily for the villains of the story.
Those were the bodies the police described? All shot with a high-powered rifle?
Barring a hell of a coincidence, I'd call it a match. There was a fourth, too, just a kid who they'd hired for $5 as a lookout. I let him go.
And then you went back and did Gant.
Hell yes, I did. Fraudulent inducement I'm mature enough to just walk away from. I'll never do business with you again, but okay, I'll figure nice try and we can just live and let live. Fixing to kill me on top of the fraud, though? Well, that kind of rudeness I cannot abide. Anyway, I just thought I'd check in and see what you might tell me. I'm hoping I haven't done something that could stir up undue animosity regarding the late and hopefully unlamented Mr. Gant.
Understood, but like I said, as far as I know, no one's claimed him yet.
Son, we've known each other long enough for me to recognize when you're trying to make something sound harder than it really is.
Why would I do that? Kanazaki said, and Docs could hear the smile behind it.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe to extract concessions in return. So look, don't exhaust yourself or anything, but maybe you could just do a little discreet digging. This UN official, the Dalai Lama, Gant told me his name is Vanek Van, though I expect you already know that.
Why do you expect that? Kanazaki said, and again Docs could hear the smile.
Because Van's a material witness to a homicide, and the Cambodian police would have taken his name and shared it with the embassy. Look, I don't mean to be unkind, but I'm really not in the mood for too many games here.
There was a pause, then Kanazaki said, You're right. His name is Van. He's the head of a UN task force called the Global Initiative to Fight Human Trafficking, GIFT. I know him.
You know him how?
Come on, sources and methods. You know that.
Docs considered. If Van were some kind of covert CIA asset, Kanazaki would never have let on anything at all. It must have been something more casual. An access agent, maybe. Or just a professional acquaintance.
Fine. Well, I reckon Mr. Van is still in danger, and I'd like to warn him.
I'm not objecting, but are you sure you want to get further involved in this, whatever it is?
Hell, how much further involved could I get than I already am? Besides, it wouldn't sit right with me to learn a week from now that someone finished the job and I could have done something about it and didn't. Think about it. The poor son of a bitch probably doesn't even realize he was the target. He probably thinks old Gant was. He won't think to watch his back, not even now. But look, it's not just what I have to tell him. Aren't you curious about what he might tell me? Don't you want to know more about what the U.S. intelligence community, of which you are a part, is up to with this? Not to mention what your tax dollars are funding.
He paused to let that sink in. Kanazaki was no greenhorn anymore, and part of his rise in the community was surely due to his knack for developing off-the-books sources of information like Docs and sources of action when action was called for. He was less able to resist a morsel of secret insight than Docs was able to resist a beautiful woman, which was to say, not able at all.
What are you trying to find out, exactly? Kanazaki said.
Who was behind Gant, for one thing? If I know that, maybe I can bury the hatchet.
How do you mean? If you're going to bury the hatchet in someone's head, I can't help you.
Where I bury it is up to them. Somebody made a dumb play that got old Gant killed. If they'll leave it at that, so will I. If not, they're going to have themselves a problem.
But so will you.
I'm assuming I already do. It's why I called you.
There was a pause. Then Kanazaki said,
It's interesting that this was about Sorm, or at least ostensibly about him, because he used to be one of ours.
What do you mean, ours?
And what do you mean, used to? And you sure waited a long time to tell me the name Sorm meant something to you, if you don't mind my saying.
Sorry about that. I just wanted a little more context first.
Docs let that go. He talked too much and elicited too little, and Kanazaki had taken temporary advantage, which was his training and probably his nature, too. You couldn't fairly blame a man for acting in accordance with his nature. You could only remember your own mistake so as not to repeat it next time.
He waited, and after a moment, Kanazaki continued. Sorm is former Khmer Rouge. Started working with the agency in 1979, right after Vietnam invaded Cambodia, and the U.S. started secretly arming the Khmer Rouge in response.
The aunt had told Docs that Sorm was Khmer Rouge. The man sure seemed to have mixed in a lot of truth with his lies, which was generally the right way to go in these matters.
But as welcome as the confirmation was, he decided to act surprised. Kanazaki was a good man, but could sometimes be professionally slippery.
Khmer Rouge, Doc said. How old is this guy?
He was the nephew of Kang Kek Yu, Nomdiger Comrade Duch, the Khmer Rouge leader in charge of their prison and interrogation network.
Interrogation? You mean torture.
That's right. Sorm was only 15 in 1975 when the Khmer Rouge took power, and 19 when the Vietnamese invaded. He spoke fluent French. A lot of the Khmer Rouge leadership studied in Paris, and Sorm was born there. The agency didn't have a lot of Khmer speakers at the time, and the Khmer Rouge promoted Sorm as the conduit for arms supplies, both because of his family ties to the leadership and because of his language skills.
I thought the Khmer Rouge killed all the Cambodians who could speak other languages.
They did. Apparently they weren't particularly attuned to irony.
I'd call it hypocrisy, but yeah. So Sorm was your guy. But why used to be?
We cut him loose after Vietnam withdrew its forces from the country.
Why cut him loose? Didn't need him anymore?
More or less. We wanted to inflict some payback on the Vietnamese so badly after they beat us that we were willing to work with a genocidal regime to do it. But after they withdrew, that rationale was done. Simple cost-benefit.
Come on, a guy like Sorm would still have lots of intel value, even after the Vietnamese withdrew. And yeah, sure, there's some public relations risk in getting in bed with the Khmer Rouge, but you'd already done that for a whole decade, which is what I believe fancy economists call a sunk cost. You're not telling me the whole story.
You're not giving me a chance. You're right, it wasn't just the Khmer Rouge connection in general. I told you. Sorm was the nephew of Comrade Duch, who became the first Khmer Rouge leader to be tried by the UN Cambodia Tribunal on Crimes Against Humanity and Genocide for his role in administering the Khmer Rouge prison system. Sorm himself was in charge of the most notorious of those prisons, Tuol Sleng, where all but 7 of 20,000 prisoners were executed. That's the Genocide Museum today.
Correct. This Comrade Duch, when they tried him, he implicated Sorm?
Correct again. It turned out Sorm was even worse than we knew. It wasn't just torture and murder. His specialty was sexual humiliation and rape. Male, female, young, old. He would rape parents in front of their children. Children in front of their parents. Nothing was too grotesque for him.
My lord.
Yes. Imagine what it would take to distinguish yourself during 5 years of genocide on grounds of cruelty and sadism.
But apparently he wasn't distinguished enough to frighten away the intelligence community.
Listen, my friend, you're no choir boy yourself. You know that the best intel, maybe even the only truly worthwhile intel, comes from bad people. And Sorm definitely had a lot of intel goodies to offer. His contacts were extensive, he was a great access agent, and his knowledge of what was going on in various Southeast Asian separatist groups and insurgencies was invaluable. But still, there are limits. When we learned from Comrade Duch's testimony just how bad Sorm really was, we stopped using him.
Docs laughed.
You make it sound like principle, not public relations.
I wasn't there at the time, and it wasn't my call, but I don't see why it couldn't be both.
I suppose. Call me a cynic if you like.
Anyway, if the guy with Van really was U.S. intelligence, someone's going to claim him.
Can you find out? I could contact the buddy who put me in touch with Gant in the first place, but I doubt he'd know anything himself. And besides, seeing how this whole op was supposed to end with me out of the picture, I'm not feeling especially trustful just now toward anyone who helped bring me into it.
You think Rain could have set you up? I can't imagine him doing that.
Docs was horrified.
No, I'm talking about someone else, fellow Marine from back in the day. Rain would never.
Well, that was my sense, too, but you had me worried for a minute.
Doc snorted. If a man like Rain were after you, worrying would be nothing but a waste of time. Getting your affairs in order, and fast, would be more like it.
Anyway, Doc said, my Marine buddy is a good man, but in the end a knuckle-dragger without your remarkable access and keen insights.
Now you're just trying to flatter me.
Maybe, but that doesn't mean it's untrue. You're a division chief now, right? East Asia?
I am, though it took 17 years to get here.
Long enough to know where a few bodies are buried, I reckon, and where to go looking for the others.
He was expecting more protestations about how difficult and complicated it would be to find out more about Gant. So he was pleasantly surprised when Kanazaki said simply, I've got a hunch. Let me follow up on it.
A hunch?
Let's just say that not all the members of the U.S. intelligence community have the same principles or the same public relations concerns as CIA. Doc smiled.
Well, I guess they don't call you Christians in action for nothing. Or at least, let's hope they don't.
Chapter 3 Livia grabbed a cold pack for Little's elbow from the first aid room, then led him to the 10th floor cafeteria. It was late for lunch, and the room was mostly empty. Little bought coffee for himself and the mineral water Livia had requested, and they sat at a table overlooking Fifth Avenue, the outside traffic muted by the modern building's thick glass. In the distance, the waters of Elliott Bay sparkled under a clear blue sky. Livia was glad she'd ridden the Ducati that morning, a street fighter and the fastest, best-balanced bike she'd ever owned. Maybe later she'd ride out to Alki Beach before heading home to her industrial loft in Georgetown. It had been a bad, wet winter, made bleaker by what she'd had to face from her past. But summer was here now, the darkness retreating, the days getting luxuriously longer, and she told herself the past was done. She faced it, and this time buried it, literally, in the case of poor Nassan. But watching Little as he carefully added cream and sugar to his coffee, slowly stirring it like a chef preparing a contest souffle, she was suddenly uncertain. This couldn't be about Bangkok. But then why the surprise visit? Why the ostentatiously long devotions to his coffee, a show of relaxed confidence she knew was another attempt to draw her out with silence? Maybe it was just habit. Well, she would have more information soon enough. In the meantime, the best move was to simply outwait him. When Little was satisfied with his preparations, he lifted the cup and took a sip.
Damn, that is some fine coffee, he said, nodding in appreciation. Seattle, where even police coffee is gourmet.
You put enough cream and sugar in. I imagine you could be drinking anything, Livia said, though the truth was she took her own coffee with a generous helping of milk and turbinado sugar. It tasted like her time with Rick, the adoptive uncle who had rescued her from horrors and who was one of the reasons she became a cop.
He smiled.
Well, I guess that's fair. Maybe I should have tasted it first, before sweetening it.
Or maybe you just like to sugarcoat things.
That made him laugh.
I guess that depends on the topic.
That was a cue for her to ask what the topic was, but again she waited. He took another sip of coffee.
You know, Livia, I don't want to show my cards until I'm sure you're in, but I guess you can't agree to be in until you've seen at least some of the cards I'm holding. So we're a bit stuck here.
Really? I don't feel stuck at all.
He laughed again. They said you'd be tough, and you're not disappointing me. How about this? Let me ask you a few preliminary questions. If you like my questions, and I like your answers, we'll take this a little further. If not, I'll thank you for the martial arts lesson, you thank me for the mineral water, and life goes on.
Works for me.
Good. I hope you appreciate that I haven't been trying to hide how I've checked up on you. I've read your personnel file, talked to your superiors, read the results of your background check, your psych profile, everything. And same as for a good book. Obviously, I wouldn't have kept reading if I didn't like the story.
Having a federal agent dig into your past would be uncomfortable for anyone. For her, it was worse. But for the moment, the only way she could respond would be with questions. And questions, she knew, could sometimes reveal as much as answers. So she said nothing.
"So here's the skinny," he went on. "If there's one thing everyone agrees on regarding Livia Lone, it's this. Intensity. Straight-A student. State champion wrestler. And not in a girls' league, either. That was against boys."
For the second time, she thought she saw that odd look pass across his face. She didn't know what it meant.
"And then Olympic alternate with the judo team at San Jose State," he went on. "Top of your class at the academy. And your arrest and conviction record is off the charts."
Again, she said nothing.
"But that's all just the what," he said. "The what is always right out in the open. I want to know why."
It seemed a harmless enough inquiry, which made her suspect it. "What do you mean?"
"I hope you're not going to tell me you just want to serve and protect. I'm sure that's part of it, and I'm sure it's noble. But I'm also sure it's not what gets you out of bed in the morning, or the middle of the night, for that matter, and makes you the great cop you are."
"You want to know what makes a great cop?"
"I want to know what makes you a great cop."
"The answer is the same. Compassion."
"All right. But where does all that compassion come from?"
She didn't like what he seemed to be implying, and what maybe he knew. "From being human."
"Human. Okay, I can see that. But people say you're like a warrior monk, a crusader. No interests, no hobbies, no life beyond putting away rapists."
"You make it sound like putting away rapists is a bad thing."
"No, not at all. Like I said, just trying to figure out where it comes from."
"That's something to write with? Because it's complicated."
"Try me."
"I prefer rapists to be in prison. Is it not the same for you?" Actually, she preferred them to be dead, but life was full of compromises.
"You're deflecting. I'm talking about what sounds like an obsession."
"You think I care too much?"
"Maybe."
"Maybe the problem is that people like you care too little." She was getting tired of the dance, but she wasn't going to reveal more until he did. She knew she had more leverage. He was the one who had come all the way out here from D.C. or wherever, who obviously had spent a lot of time evaluating her. He'd open up. All she had to do was outlast him.
"Oh, you'd be surprised at how much I care," he said, and for an instant she thought she detected genuine emotion in his tone.
"And in fact, your singular focus is something I admire. But I still want to understand it." In admire, she heard want to use. In understand, she heard exploit.
"Here's the thing," he went on. "Nobody seems to know about your past. It only goes as far back as your uncle, Rick Harris, in Portland, when you were finishing high school."
Only a lifetime of keeping secrets enabled her to conceal her discomfort at what she recognized as an interrogator's gambit, a direct probe into a likely sensitive area, to elicit and evaluate response. The truth was, she knew SPD hadn't looked that deeply into her background. They'd talked to her professors and judo coach at San Jose State, of course, and received glowing recommendations. And they'd contacted Rick, who had told them how he'd taken in Livia after Rick's brother-in-law Fred Lone's heart attack. Rick was a hero with the Portland Police Bureau, a homicide detective with multiple decorations for valor, so his imprimatur was golden. Beyond which, SPD had wanted her badly. Minority woman, straight-A student, collegiate judo star, and criminal justice major made for an attractive combination. They didn't know that Livia had once been La B.
"In fact," Little went on, "to the extent anyone is even aware of your past, there's a notion that you were some kind of boat person or other refugee, and the Lones adopted you. Not so unusual. Asian babies get adopted by white families all the time. Hell, some people think Loan is a Chinese name, and you're not adopted at all. You're just Chinese-American. The point is, no one really seems to know.
Was he threatening to tell people about her past? Why would he think, why would he know, this would make her uncomfortable? And did he know more than he was letting on? Not just about her past, but maybe about her present, too? But no, she was falling for another interrogator's trick, and a basic one, suggesting you knew more than you did, so the subject would feel he wasn't giving you anything you didn't already have. It helped to know the routine, though obviously knowing it wasn't a foolproof defense when you found yourself on the other end. She gave him a long, bored look.
If they don't know, she said, maybe it's because they don't care.
Or it could be they don't care because they don't know. About your sister, I mean. About how you were both trafficked and separated. How she wound up in a potter's field all the way in Maryland. I'm sorry for that, Livia. Truly sorry. His use of Nissan as some sort of elicitation tool was worse than offensive. It made her want to hurt him. A vestigial instinct, she knew. Nissan was long since beyond protecting, but the instinct was inextinguishable, like the pain of a phantom limb. A limb little was now deliberately prodding. And he knew Nissan had been buried in Maryland. It had taken Livia 16 years and one dead rapist senator to learn that. Her initial, presumably paranoid suspicion that this visit was about Bangkok rekindled. Probably his next ploy would be to ask how she had learned what had happened to Nissan and where she had been buried. But instead, he said, "Is that where the intensity comes from? Childhood trauma?"
She took a sip of mineral water, deliberately casual. "If it makes you happy, I hate to think of the resources you spent on all this background. You could have just asked me."
"Well, that's the thing about the federal government. We have so many resources to waste."
"Look, it sounds like you already know everything about me. The what and the why. Or you think you do, anyway. While I still know virtually nothing about you. Is that the way you're going to play this? If so, you'll have to find someone else to psychoanalyze. I've got cases I need to get back to."
"You feel I've been trying to psychoanalyze you?"
She finished the mineral water and set down the bottle. Reflecting the subject's words to encourage him to talk was one of the first things I learned about interviews. If I were stupid enough to fall for it, you probably wouldn't want to work with me. And if you're stupid enough to think I'd fall for it, I don't want to work with you. He laughed and held up his hands, palms forward.
"Okay, fair point. Enough fucking around, I guess. You're right. I think I know you. At least, I hope I do. Like I said earlier, I just had to see for myself."
He cleared his throat and rubbed his hands together.
"So here's the deal. HSI is trying to bust a trafficking ring in Thailand. We've had jack shit worth of success. I want your help."
So this wasn't about the senator. At least, probably it wasn't. "What kind of trafficking ring?"
"The kind that's being protected by the Thai government."
Her heart started thudding in response to an adrenaline hit. Only 2 months earlier, she had finally learned the name of the leader of the group of men that had come to her childhood village in Thailand like monsters in a fairy tale and taken her and Nissan. Chanchai Vivavapit, who, according to his Bangkok Post obituary, had been chief of the Central Investigation Bureau of the Royal Thai Police, the country's national police force. For 16 years, she had fantasized about killing the man she had always thought of simply as Skullface. But when she had finally done it, butchering him along with Senator Loan, who was both Skullface's customer and his benefactor, it hadn't been enough. There were two other men in Skullface's gang, men whose names she didn't yet know, but who she still thought of as Squarehead and Dirty Beard. And two others, the one who had been in the van and the one who had whipped that little boy, Kai, in the field, men who had helped with the transit from their village in the mountainous northwest to the port in Bangkok. And there was that girl. The little girl the senator had raped in his Bangkok hotel room, a girl about the same age Nissan had been the last time Livia had seen her.
She would never be able to get that little girl's face out of her mind. She had beseeched Livia with her agonized eyes as Matthias Redcroft, Lone's legislative aide, had led her, trembling and bleeding, away. And Livia, at gunpoint, had been helpless to do anything but watch. If she were at all inclined to respond to Little's questions about her motivations, she knew, grappling with that demon of helplessness would be at the top of the list. Not that knowing the why ever had much impact on the what. "May I take your silence as evidence of interest?" Little said. She had been trying not to let it show, but she knew her excitement might have made it to the surface. Still, she said only, "You may take it as evidence that I'm listening." He nodded.
"Well, hopefully they're one and the same. So here it is. Over the last 5 years, HSI has sent 3 different agents to liaise with the Royal Thai Police, and yet our investigation has gone precisely nowhere. And this in spite of ample intelligence demonstrating that elements of the National Police are intimately involved in every aspect of trafficking to, from, and within Thailand."
Her mind was screaming with questions, and she fought to push the urge away. This could be the chance she'd been hoping for, to finish the rest of the men who had helped Skullface, to finally make every last one of them pay. And even more than that, to find that little girl. She focused on her breathing for a moment, the way she had always done before a match. When her excitement felt sufficiently in check, she said, "What do you think has been the problem?"
Little shrugged. "A lot of it is just burnout. Emotional exhaustion. The horror of trafficking. It's incomprehensible. It's natural for the mind to want to turn away from it, to rationalize that it's just a tragic aspect of a primitive foreign culture. Something we Westerners, of course, disapprove of, but are ultimately helpless to change."
Was he trying to play some kind of ethnic card with her? She said nothing.
"But you wouldn't do that, Livia, would you? You would never rationalize horror, habituate to it. You're the kind of person who could stare horror in the face for the rest of your life and never once blink. Isn't that right?"
"Is that your assessment?"
"Hell yes, it's my assessment. You want to disagree, go right ahead. But I doubt you'd be able to convince either of us. And look, obviously it's not just that you're the kind of cop who doesn't flinch or turn away. You're also ethnic Thai. You can blend. Do you still speak the language?"
Her native language was Lahu. She had learned Thai in school, and even that had been a long time before. "I've forgotten most of it."
"Well, I'm sure it would come back quickly. And there's another advantage. You're a woman. They'll underestimate you."
She already knew she was going to say yes, but she also knew she had to continue to play it reluctant. The moment he sensed the answer was what he wanted would be the moment she lost her leverage. "You don't have any Asian female federal agents?"
"We have a few, yes. But a federal agent would be wrong for this. We've tried that route, and I told you, it's led nowhere."
"I don't understand."
"I want someone to liaise with the Royal Thai Police under the guise of learning more about international trafficking networks. A city cop who combats trafficking at the street level. Someone who works the demand side and could be even more effective via a closer understanding of the supply side. A holistic approach." It sounded like jargon, though to the people who approved the budget, she imagined it would sound cutting edge.
"You said under the guise."
"Correct. Not that there would be no independent value to the exercise. I expect there will be, otherwise the subterfuge would fail. But no, the ostensible purpose of your visit is intended to conceal the actual purpose."
She didn't like the way he had transitioned from would to will, and from a generic someone to specifically her. "And the actual purpose?"
"Well, to analogize for a moment to the war on drugs, we're doing street-level busts, we're getting points on the board. But cost is down, purity up, availability unaffected."
"You're saying the supply isn't being disrupted?"
"Correct." Why are only street-level traffickers getting taken down? Because Thai officials are cooperating with or complicit with or protecting the higher-ups, which is ultimately where the money flows. A street-level bust is like cutting off a tentacle. Hell, the tip of a tentacle. The animal will barely notice. We need to go after the head. So our actual purpose is find out who's protecting whom and how we can get around that protection or through it. Now, it was our purpose, something she taught her women's self-defense students to recognize as forced teaming, when a person suggests he has something in common with his intended victim to get her to drop her guard.
How do you know so much about Thai government complicity? She said.
Well, obviously there's the fact that there are nothing but low-level trafficking busts. But beyond that, I'm afraid it's all classified.
She wasn't expecting him to show his cards, but the answer is always no if you don't ask. So you want me to go to Thailand? She said, her tone deliberately dubious.
Bangkok, specifically, and only for 6 months, maybe less, depending on how your investigation proceeds.
6 months to track Skullface's men, to find that little girl. It was like a dream. But there was more she wanted, and she wouldn't get it if he sensed she was eager.
6 months? She said, recoiling as though shocked. You know, despite your impression that I'm a monk or whatever, I have a life here. Cases to work, classes I teach, people who need me. What makes you think I can just drop all that for your project?
He leaned back in his seat and studied her.
In the end, it's a question of priorities. You can stay here in Seattle and fight the alligators, or you can go to the source and drain the damn swamp.
Well, he liked his animal metaphors, and actually, they weren't bad ones. They sat in silence, regarding each other. She knew he wasn't going to speak first. That was okay. She didn't need him to go first to get what she wanted. She only needed to sweat him for a little while longer. So she let the silence spin out for almost a full minute before she said, I want to see your files.
Out of the question.
She sensed that was theater, intended to make a coming concession feel more valuable than it really was. I'm talking about the basis for the case you expect me to build.
I understand that, but
I'm not going to give you an answer until I have an idea of what I'd be getting into, who I'd be going after, and how much of a chance there would even be that I could succeed. If you're planning to send me off based on nothing but speculation, in 6 months I won't be able to accomplish anything. If you have solid leads and usable intel, then yeah, maybe there's a chance we could cut off the head or drain the swamp or however you want to put it. Otherwise, I'm not interested. He looked away and drummed his fingers on the table. Rationally, she knew she had him. She was sure of it. But she was never going to have a better chance or a better means to go after Skullface's men and find that little girl. And she wanted it all so badly, she couldn't help feeling afraid he was going to say no. After a minute, he looked at her and nodded.
The information is all classified. So, just so you know, I'm breaking more than protocol here. I'm breaking the law. I'm showing you a lot of trust. I hope that's a two-way street.
Show me your files, she said, relief and excitement washing through her. And we'll see.
Chapter 4. That afternoon, Dox was walking down a wide, dusty street west of the Besak River and the Mekong just beyond it. He mopped his brow, taking in his surroundings, reflexively noting the places that would make for good sniper hides and ambush locations. Everything seemed copacetic. He was amazed at how, outside the city center, so much of Phnom Penh was practically rural. There were more bicycles than tuk-tuks, and so little engine din that as he walked he could hear insects buzzing in the trees. The buildings were smaller, too, the empty lots between them populated with scrawny chickens and lounging dogs. But there was a lot of construction, and he had a feeling that in just a few years this district would be choked with fancy apartments and Starbucks signs. He was glad for the opportunity to see it before all that happened. If Kanazaki came through and set up a meeting with Van, Docs wanted to be familiar with the terrain, so he'd found the address of the Phnom Penh UN offices and decided to have a first-hand look. He strolled along, taking his time, and presently arrived at a four-story concrete building, one of the larger and sturdier-looking structures on the block. The blue sign in front said, Office